This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry, and some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs. United Healthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts, Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm wondering, Jen, how are you doing today?
I am doing, well, wait, first I'm going to say, today our guest on the show is the author Jamie Lowe, and later on the show, we talked to Jamie Lowe about her new book, Breathing Fire, which is a book about the female inmate firefighters fighting California wildfires, and Jamie also wrote a book called Mental about her mental health. But in answer to your question, I'm okay. I think actually you're the one with the bigger thing to talk about this week.
Well, I had a little, you know, I went to urgent care today. I've been having these kind of like sharp pains in my right side, in my chest. And I went to the doctor a little while ago and my blood pressure was very high. So she said, keep an eye on that, you know. And of course, I bought a blood pressure monitor and did it once and then didn't keep an eye on that. But over the weekend, I started getting really worried. Like, what, you know, I'm having tingling in my arm. So we went to urgent care. They did an EKG. They did everything else. And it turns out I'm fine. But, you know, I do have this high blood pressure. And I was just thinking on the way back from the doctor, like, I'll be 60 in 3 years. Like, it is time, Kim. It is time to start eating small quantities of food that has been steamed. It is time to start exercising. It's time to start behaving like somebody who is getting older and wants to live a long time. And I feel a little resigned to it. But I also feel a little ashamed that, you know, I'm 3 years from 60 and just now figuring this out.
Well, you know? I mean, yes, I do know. I know all of that. And one of the things we talked about when we talked this morning, I got on some hormone replacement therapy and I've been fucking it all up. They missed a very like clutch instruction of when I'm supposed to take them with the pharmacy. They didn't include it in the instructions. And then I also was inconsistent with taking them and my body has been crazy. I've similarly had like some tingling and all kinds of fucked up things in my body. And what keeps coming up again and again, and what I keep resisting, is I need to be consistent for the first time in my life. Like, I need to have a level of care and consistency. And I take pretty good care of myself, but not consistently. And like, even I asked you, like, are you drinking enough water? It's so stupid. I'm The thing is, you said, I forget what you said, but I thought you were going to say resentful. Oh, you said resigned. I thought you were going to say resentful because I am resentful that my body is requiring, and I should just be grateful because it could, things could be so much worse. But I'm a little resentful that I have to be so consistent or I feel so out of whack. And I do, and then I feel ashamed. Like, why can't I just be a grown up about this? Why am I not drinking whatever it is at this point, a gallon of water a day? Why don't I take my fish oil every morning and my vitamin D every morning? Like, why do I skip things? Why am I failing myself?
Yep. And that's exactly how it feels to me. Like, I look at my mother and she has mastered being 84 years old. You know, she's got it down. She's got her routines. She swims in the bay every day in the summer. Like, why can't I be more like that?
Well, what is the resistance? Because it's obviously what keeps being messaged to both of us. Now, like, whatever you said about, like, so let me go back. Whatever you said about why am I just learning this now? Well, first off, because this shit is boring. Like, let's just be honest. It is boring. And like, it wasn't necessary for either of, for whatever reason, you know, luck, genetics, it wasn't necessarily necessary for either of us until this point in our physical lives, right? Like, now it's necessary. So then it's like, well, it's obviously necessary. The messages my body keeps saying is you cannot really drink anymore. That's over for you. Caffeine, not so much. For me, it's even like dairy and sugar. It's just like, just not working out, you know?
Right.
But like, why I'm in this new tailspin with my body is I had a night where I was like, I'm going to drink. I'm going to eat a whole cheese plate to myself. I'm going to have some chocolate chip cookies. And like, I just had this like binge and it set me off for like a week because my body just cannot handle that anymore. Yeah. Or at least in this second where I am in this goddamn perimenopause, it can't handle it. I'm also, by the way, in one of those forever periods. Sorry for listeners, but I'm in one of those like, when will it end? Like, who knows? Who knows? I just keep hitting the button on the tracker. Yep, another day. There we go.
Wow.
But what it feels like is this feels like the ultimate self-care, right? This consistency. It's not pulling out a face mask. It's not buying a $200, you know, serum. Mm-hmm. This is the ultimate self-care right now. How much do we care about ourselves to consistently take care of ourselves, to drink the water, to sleep, to get as much sleep as we possibly can, to goddamn exercise?
Mm-hmm. I think that's an excellent point, and I think you're really right. I think you're right. It is.
I wasn't trying to shame you, though. I love
no,
you.
No,
I,
no,
all
no,
I have is compassion for you.
Me, you, my friend. Okay. But my friend. I said that like I was, I don't know, Robin Hood or something. No, I feel like it's a really good point and kind of a empathetic point, right? That this is really a thing we can do for ourselves and trying to practice so much shame around not doing it and just do it.
Just do it. I mean, the themes are emerging, right? The themes are emerging. Like I've been doing a lot of cleaning out of closets and drawers because we keep talking about this stuff. Like, it's making me feel kind of, I just am changing. So the things that worked before, like a closet you opened and everything fell out, just, I didn't care. And I was in therapy for years, like talking to therapists about like, why don't any of my spoons match? And the therapist was like, maybe you don't care about that. And I was like, you're right, I don't. But now order in all aspects of my life feels good and feels like something I want to commit to because it makes me feel better.
And it makes the unknown a little less scary.
Yes. 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 But there is a thing of, you know, our bodies are a mystery and we should do the things that we think are right. You know, drink the water, do the exercising, try to sleep. Eat as well as possible. Don't eat, you know, foods that don't make you feel well. I do think there is a thing of, in the wellness industrial complex of just, and this is why we feel bad, because there is so much shaming. It's designed to make us feel shame, this like alternative health, like, well, it's your responsibility. Like, no, bodies are fucked up and weird. Like, you can only do so, you could do to a certain point, but like, you could also drive yourself crazy, like doing a juice cleanse and, oh, now I'm doing this and I'm going to get a colonic and blah, blah, blah. Like, as if you have, it creates this false sense of control that you don't really have.
Yep. Yep. I think that's true.
I don't know if that's a contradiction, but how are you feeling now?
I feel all right. I feel all right. You know, came home, talked to you, continue with the day. And now, I mean, I felt like getting the EKG was a good thing, because otherwise I was going to be going absolutely crazy, you know?
Right. And but the thing, right, driving yourself crazy. But the thing was, what you said to me, and this is what's so funny, is that so much of the time, because our muscles and bones don't work the same way, I'm finding this too. So much of the time, it's like I carried something weird, and the next day I'm like, I'm having a heart attack. And what was it? You said it was a pinched nerve, right?
Yeah, well, Paul was saying we just got off of a bus. We were on a bus for 2 weeks. You don't think you were sitting in some weird position that caused that? Like, why not go there instead of heart attack?
Right, right. And part of the self-care is also not catastrophizing.
Yep. Yep, I think it's really important and exhausting to those around you.
Oh, well, totally, totally. I mean, I have to like trade out who I talk to about things. You know, did I tell you, and I don't know if I said this on the podcast, but my mother-in-law lives basically, she doesn't live in like a formalized retirement community, but everyone who lives around her is retired, and they go for walks, and they have a rule that they can only talk about their health for 5 minutes.
That's awesome.
Which I think is smart, because I think, you know, shit's just going to start breaking down. I have a friend who's our age who's just like experiencing like all this weird nerve stuff in her like left side, and nobody can figure out what it is. It's like changing hormones, changing bodies, getting older.
Yep. Yep. It's true. Things just, you know, they break down a little easier.
They break down a little easier, but I'm glad. Yeah. I'm okay.
I'm okay. I'm great. Things are fine. You know, ready for fall. How about
everything
you?
Everything is fine. Everything is fine.
Everything is fine. Everything's fine. Okay, with that, let's get into this episode, which I think everyone is really going to like.
Me too. Our guest today is Jamie Lowe. Jamie is the author of the new book, Breathing Fire, about incarcerated female firefighters on the front lines of California's wildfires as the state is ravaged by climate change. She previously published the 2018 memoir, Mental, Lithium, Love, and Losing My Mind, and Digging for Dirt, The Life and Death of ODB, a biography of Old Dirty Bastard. She's a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine and has created audio pieces for both Radiolab and This American Life. Welcome, Jamie. Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh my God, it's such a pleasure to have you. And this book is so fascinating and also such an accomplishment. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks.
So I know the answer to this already, but I'm going to ask because I know listeners don't know. What drew you to write this book about female firefighters?
So I'm from California. I grew up in Los Angeles. I was born in Oakland, and I spend a lot of time at home because my family is there. And I was at home at my mom's house reading the LA Times. And I was reading this article, and there was a under 500 word story about a woman who had died, who was incarcerated, who was fighting a wildfire. And her name was Shauna Lynn Jones. And I was just completely struck by two things. One, that this program existed, that there were 44 camps throughout California that were made up of incarcerated firefighters, and that also were 30% of the wildland firefighters in California at the time. And that they were, you know, they were prisoners and firefighters at the same time. And the second part that really struck me was that Shauna Lynn Jones was basically reduced to about two sentences And it all revolved around her crime and that she was from Lancaster, California. And I felt like I really just wanted to know more about her. And that's where it started.
So how long did it take you to write and report this out? Or to report this? I mean, I imagine it was a lot of reporting.
Yeah, it was, it started as a magazine article. And I started that when I read the newspaper article. It was February 2016. And I spent like a year and a half working on the article, which is way too long to work on anything that is ultimately 5,000 words. But I was able to, in that time, visit all three of the female camps, go to the training camp, which is at the main women's state prison. And when the article came out and I decided I wanted to actually expand it into a book, it was really, really important to me to talk about and to interview women who I had come across while I was at the camps, who had lived through the program and who then were, you know, experiencing reentry and whether or not the program actually helped them. So I guess the beginning of it was 5 years ago. And then, you know, I'm a freelance writer, so I can't spend every second on one project. And so I sort of toggle between a couple of things. But, you know, it was part of my life for 5 years. That's longer than a lot of relationships I've had.
Me too.
Totally. No, they really opened up to you. How did you think about gaining trust, and how did you think about what you were going to do with that trust once you gained it? Do you know what I mean? Like, this is a really intimate relationship in a lot of ways, you know, telling these women's stories.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always shocked that people are willing to be interviewed in the first place. Like, it's always the first hurdle and something that I think is so sacred, because it really is it's so much trust, and it's trust in a stranger. And I honestly don't know what compels people to do it, except that I think for the most part, I just try and explain exactly what I want to do and that I want to tell their story. And most people want their stories told, especially if they feel like they haven't had the opportunity to actually talk about what's going on. And when you're part of a formerly incarcerated population, or you are incarcerated, there are huge restrictions on what you can say about your life and what your life has been. Like, some of it is that people just don't care or hear about it. And some of it is that when you are incarcerated, you're just not allowed to talk about it.
Like, it's against the rules, literally.
Yeah, I mean, everything is monitored. Everything could potentially be added to your sentence. They're prisoners. Their bodies belong to the state.
Wow. So would that be... So anyway, yeah. So, they earn, in this program, right, they earn 8 to 95 cents an hour. And this job is like totally dangerous, totally exhausting, but it's also considered a great job. Why is that?
So they actually earn less than that. They earn, when I started reporting, they earned $2.56 a day in camp when it wasn't fire season, and then a dollar an hour when they were on the fire lines. And it's since been raised to $5 a day in camp and a dollar an hour on the fire lines, which is shocking compared to civilian pay, which is also shockingly low. So there's that. But one of the things that makes it attractive in prison, there's a lot of things. One is that it is one of the highest paid jobs within prison industries, which tells you a lot about the rest of the jobs, which are sometimes 2 cents an hour, 20 cents an hour. The other part of it is that you're not living in a state prison, which is, you know, described to me by the women I interviewed, but then also in so many other records as this dehumanizing, this place of, I mean, it sounds like hell to me. There's the food is horrible. There's like violence, there's sexual predation from correctional officers. There's no sense of safety or, you know, it's basically a day-to-day survival thing. And when you're in camp, you're actually in the woods. You're in these like really kind of beautiful places without fences. Your families can visit. You know, one of the women I talked to recently was describing to me visiting with her daughter at state prison, where they could only touch hands against plexiglass window. But when she was in camp, you know, they could hug each other and there was like actual physical contact. And they can, you can rent a cabin for a night and have your family stay over. There's better food. You're, you know, out there working. You're putting your life on the line, but you're serving your time in a way that it passes quicker, I think, is what was described.
Is it worse for the women than it is for the men, do you think? I mean, or what is the, what are the differences? I mean, because there's also male incarcerated firefighters, right?
Right. And there's juvenile incarcerated firefighters.
Really?
Too. Yeah.
That's kind of mind blowing.
Completely. I think they're trying to do less juvenile firefighting, but
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. I didn't write about the men and I didn't interview that many men. The people I've came across who were formerly incarcerated firefighters who were men were less, I didn't interview them formally. And so I don't know exactly what the differences are, but the one thing that's really different about being on a female crew than in the free world is that they're all female. And so when you're trying to get into firefighting in the free world, you're one woman usually on a crew of all men. And it's incredibly, it's very sexist. It's very difficult and discriminatory to actually succeed as a female firefighter in the free world. But in the incarcerated program, because it's all women, there's this sort of equal playing field where everybody can kind of work together on the same level.
It doesn't seem quite fair that they're not allowed to become civilian firefighters upon their release.
It is most definitely not fair. And it's kind of nuanced because forestry, the federal firefighters, they actually will accept firefighters if they have felonies on their record. So it's possible. It's really, really hard. There are still a lot of hurdles to overcome. You have to retake all of the testing that you've already done in camp. You have to redo all of the training, even if you've worked three seasons. And so you have to start all over. And there's, when you're facing reentry, which is one of the more difficult parts of incarceration, and you're trying to enter into this really difficult field with no support, both financially and just in terms of what to do, it's really, really difficult.
Do you think that we should continue programs like this in prisons? I mean, on the one hand, it feels really exploitative, particularly the pay. But on the other hand, it seems like a better way to support rehabilitation, particularly if there is an opportunity to pursue this as a profession, if you're a woman who's, you know, really likes it.
I think that the program should exist, and I think it should exist independently of CDCR, the Corrections Department of California. And I think that, you know, one way that you could do that is to fold it onto the California Conservation Corps. Or, you know, I think in the infrastructure bill, there's the Civilian Climate Corps is one of the suggestions. And I think we absolutely need, you know, an army of people fighting climate change. And if these women and these men and juveniles are, you know, safe enough to be out there fighting fires, then they should be able to do that as free people.
And now let's take a quick break for some ads.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And we're back.
I want to switch gears here. Because you also wrote a book about your struggle with bipolarity. Was it difficult to out yourself in this way?
That's a really good question. And, you know, I have always been really open with it. And I think that's because I was diagnosed when I was 16 and I was in high school. And it's always been a big part of my identity. And I didn't really, I think that part of this is my personality, which I'm a little bit dumb about things. And I'm just like, well, I guess I'll do that. And like, it didn't occur to me that I should be nervous or worried about it. The first time there was any like red light feeling was that it was originally an article for the Times Magazine, and my editor before he was going to submit the pitch to the top editors and the editor in chief, he looked at me and he was like, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And I was like, "Yeah, duh. Like, of course I do. Like, I want to write about this and this seems like a great place to write about it." And I didn't really think about it. I didn't think about, you know, what it would mean in any way, which is dumb, but also, you know,
open. Yeah. You could be brave. Nice to yourself. Brave, exactly.
I mean, it just wasn't a conscious choice, because I think sometimes I'm like, well, this seems like the next move, I guess. I had always been very vocal about it with anyone who wanted to talk to me about it. And because I am a writer, it seemed natural to write about it. I think also growing up, my mom really used writing as like a way of expressing feelings when I was like really angry or pissed off. I was like, you know, very emotionally volatile child, and she would always just be like, go write it down. And I think that was like her device to like get me to sit down in a different room and sort of try and navigate it. Right. And so,
or self-regulate too. I mean, that's a good tool for that, I think. Yeah. Go ahead, continue.
No, yeah. One of the reasons why this is so compelling to me is that this isn't something I talk about a lot, but in 2005, an antidepressant I was taking triggered bipolarity in me. Mm-hmm. I was diagnosed with bipolar 2, which for those of you who don't know is like being bipolar, but with slightly better luck than bipolar 1. But some of your passages were actually painful for me to read. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read this one, even though it's a little long, because it really struck me. After a few months off of lithium, I felt energetic, engaged, even electric. It's hard to know if that feeling was just a ramping up toward mania again, or if it was the lifting of a lithium fog. But this is what ended up happening. I turned down jobs and burned all professional bridges with sharp and illogical emails, many of them referring to Eminem. I kept a stash of homemade granola in my pocket to hand out to anyone who would accept a stranger's dirty pocket granola. I developed an alter ego, a rapper named Jamya. I painted my face with spectacular green and gold eyeshadow. I was kicked out of a bar without even drinking. I stood on my head every morning. My apartment burned down. I served as the sole witness to a stranger's wedding at the top of the World Trade Center. I wore 800 necklaces and spoke in a slow growl or sometimes a high-pitched squeal. I saved a corgi from being hit by a cab on Central Park West, on which occasion Ben Vereen stopped to call a dog ambulance. I spoke to strangers with the intensity of a car salesman stuck in a David Mamet monologue. I preached about Jesus wherever I went, which for a Jew is unusual. I spent almost $700 on butternut squash and assorted seasonal gourds. My clothes smelled of fire from the burned out apartment. I scared the scary people on the subway. All that took place over 2 weeks, maybe three, as I made my way back and forth between Los Angeles and New York. I was like literally painful for me to read because I remember that feeling of mania so well. And the weird, like the moment when it becomes something dangerous, you know, when it's not just sort of being on this like, you know, rush of feeling, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, because that's the precipice, right? That's when... that's the hardest point to recognize if you're in the throes of a manic episode. You don't recognize that, you know, the people around you do. And then sometimes you don't hear them or listen to them.
How was it for you to revisit that time?
It's hard. It's really hard because it's one of the most, I don't want to romanticize mania in any way, but it's also one of the most oddly dynamic and scary and like raw times of my life, where there just so much happened all at once. And so much of that was because there is no filter when you're manic and you just start engaging in everything for better and more often worse. And I think that, you know, there was a sense of loss when I started taking lithium again, and depression and sort of mourning, where I would look back on that time and think like, that person was me. I experienced that, but I am not that person. And now I don't know how to access that again. And it often, you know, I think my first psychiatrist described mania as being high on cocaine. And, you know, I've done cocaine a little bit, and it's like not even close. Mania is way crazier and better. And so it's like, it's just, it's really hard to revisit because there's this feeling of like, how did all of this happen? Why did all of this happen? What does it mean? Who was I then? Who am I now? How does it all relate to, you know, the future, and how is it braided together? And so it was hard, but it was also really, instructive and kind of like important, I think, for me to look back on it and have some resolutions about that time period. And I think I did it at a time in my life that was like far enough away from it where I had figured out a little bit more about who I am independently of, you know, being identified as bipolar, which is ironic because I'm like, now I'm a person. Here's a book about me being bipolar.
It's interesting. I imagine that mental health diagnosis, sort of any diagnosis, as we get older and we just can, part of the gift of middle age is the full acceptance and the radical acceptance of the self wherever you are. And I wonder if, you know, age helped. And I don't know if that's been your experience, Jamie, but just like fully being like, oh yeah, That's part of me. That's part of what I am. It doesn't define me, but it's part of me. I wonder if that's been your experience, and it, getting older has been actually like a gift for that.
100%. I feel like, I mean, not only is getting older a gift for that, but it's also as you get older, your mental health completely changes. And sometimes what you're diagnosed with and how it affects you changes. I think that there are different phases of different diagnoses. There are different symptoms. And then you just have more tools, especially if you're really engaged with it. You know, you keep working and figuring out what you need and how you can find that, and also how to kind of accept feelings and big feelings, which is, you know, some people describe bipolar as big feelings. I think that's a little bit of a euphemism, but it's true.
Did you have shame around your behavior? And if so, how did you manage that?
I definitely did. It took me a long time to realize that I had shame around it. And I think part of that was when I reported the story about cognitive processing therapy. That was one of the things I really resisted, where I was like, I'm not ashamed. Like, it just happened. It was who I, you know, it's who I am. And, but I think the reality is that there are people that I know that I met while I was manic, like for the first time, and we still know each other. And there are people who I have met since, like, way since then, and don't know anything about what manic behavior is. And then there are friends who I've known since sixth grade who have been there the whole way. And I think, yeah, you know, professionally especially, shame came into play, because it was, thank God, not really the era of social media. But I sent a lot of emails that were not appropriate.
I invented a feud between myself and another fashion editor.
Oh my God.
And I was in Milan at the fashion shows, and I walked up to him and I said something like, I don't know what your problem with me is, but I wish you would get over it. Something like that. And he looked at me and he said, I don't know who you are.
Have you talked to him since?
No.
I mean,
it was so mortifying.
Yeah, sometimes though, that those conversations, I mean, I'm sure it was like a blip, and there are so many things happening, but sometimes just that, and I think writing the book really, because I did go back and talk to everyone, made me realize what other people's narratives were around what I experienced. And
Right. That's
something about mental health that I don't know as intimately what it's like to be around somebody who's actually, you know, going crazy, and what that means and how you support them. It's a lot harder to sort of imagine that when you're in the throes of it. And I have friends who are bipolar, and sometimes I really am. I mean, I sometimes feel shame about how I respond, because I am like, I know intimately what's happening, but I can't figure out what to do.
Well, also, you become kind of unlikable when you're manic. You know, you become really, you can, anyway, I should say.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
very
sure.
Delusional. You think everything would run better if you were running it.
Yeah.
You know, I have friends from that time who just were like, they checked out and they never came back. And I think some of it has to do with those people being assholes. But I think some of it also has to do with the fact that mental health issues are still so incredibly stigmatized.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard, right?
Why is it still so hard at a time when so many things that used to be stigmatized have become accepted?
You know, I think that it's just, it's similar to addiction issues. It's similar in that I think that it's hard not to take behavior personally, and it's hard not to look at someone, hear them, and and say, I know that you're suffering, and so what you're saying is not true, or it's not real, or you're going to shift back to the person I know and love. It's really hard to not, to like acknowledge what's happening and then also acknowledge another reality, which is that they're suffering. I think that when you're talking about intimate and personal relationships, you know, having somebody who is not a reliable narrator is just really difficult. And I think sometimes that's what mental health can be. And maybe that's a bad phrase for it, because you are the narrator you are, and whatever you are saying and doing is what's happening. But it's hard not to respond to that. That said, you know, I feel like stigma with mental health has really evolved in a lot of ways. And I'm not sure it's 100% for the better, but the conversation is much more out there than it was, I think, when I was 16. And I'm trying to think of what year that was. It was like 1993. I'm old. But it was not talked about. There weren't kids like that were diagnosed. It was rare. Now I think, you know, I talk with my friends who have kids, and most kids have the time of this like school day when everyone's taking medications of various, and you know, and my friends are like, I don't feel like that's good. It seems like that's normalized and it's too young. And I'm like, look, if, you know, if there was advances in heart health and it meant that people were taking medications to deal with it, you wouldn't question it. And I think it's important to think a lot about what's happening. And I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of, it's a really unknown terrain, right? The brain is difficult to, it's impossible to figure out.
You've been living with this bipolarity for a long time. What advice would you give somebody who had just been diagnosed?
Well,
like what have you learned? What are your best like life hacks for a bipolar person?
Zero. I would not take my advice. No, I think like that's a really complicated question, because I think diagnosis can come at a lot of different times for people. You know, they can have experienced so many different cycles of mania or depression prior to diagnosis, and then have this aha moment where it's this absolute relief, or it can come at the first time something's happening and they are completely thrown off by, you know, any mental health shift. So it kind of depends on what the symptoms are and have been, I think. For me, I think just building as much support as possible in terms of just friends, psychiatrists, like anything you can possibly do, you should do it. And there's always the very basic things, which I often forget and like need to check in with myself about regularly, which is like, what are you eating? Are you sleeping? And are you exercising? Those are really important things that I neglect all the time, because who wants to exercise a lot?
Right.
But I do find, like, you know, if I'm really, really agitated, if I'm feeling horrible and I get outside and walk for 45 minutes, I'm a different person afterwards. And I, you know, that's maybe a shitty response, but there's like, that's the smallest thing.
And yeah, breathing. No, move a muscle, change a thought.
Yeah. Breathing helps.
Equally, I wonder, what would either of you say, because since you've both struggled with some serious mental health issues, what would either of you say, how were you best supported? How should we be supporting people who are going through struggles with their mental health? Like, what helped you, either of you?
Such a good question.
Yeah. I think having people around you who are willing to be there the duration, I mean, because you don't know how long it's going to take. And there are lots of phases of recovery. And, you know, recovery is somewhat of a fallacy. Like, we're kind of constantly trying to get to the point of this concept of normal, which I don't think is real. I think there's a different normal every day. You're, you know, I think basically, you know, thinking back to the end of my last episode, the support I needed the most was probably my family, because I was 25 and I had, like, you know, burned all my bridges professionally by sending lots of crazy emails, and I had no home, and I had this, like, wild idea that I had fallen in love and wanted to get married to this person I did not know before the manic episode, and was determined to do so. But, you know, my family and my mom was, like, so frustrated. I mean, she's this adorable little person who is also incredibly fierce and swears like a truck driver. And there were days, I think, where she was just like, I can't deal. Like, I would be chain smoking on the porch and she was like, you have to go around the block. I can't see this. I can't, like, this is too much. Like, I can't deal with you. And I think that, you know, ultimately there was the patience of my parents are divorced. I've had step parents that have been involved in my life since I was 18 months old. And I had this village that was sort of all sort of taking turns trying to make sure I wasn't, I don't know, getting married to a stranger.
Fine.
Or worse. That wouldn't have been the worst thing, probably.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking, like, because I sort of just feel like the things that helped me, the people that helped me when I was really out of control, were the people who refused to be pissed off at me, who told me when I did something wrong or said something objectionable, but who refused to just get stuck in this anger at me, because the people who were just angry at me were no help at all. They made it worse. They made me double down.
Yeah.
So holding space is what we're saying. Holding space for another person, non-judgmental space.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Also, you know, thinking back a little bit on it, and I think this has carried over to, like, non-manic times and non-depressed times for me, is that I was really lucky. I felt like a lot of times the universe caught me in ways that it didn't need to. Like, people who were complete strangers really kind of stepped in and saw that I was going through something and kind of, like, silently helped, and maybe not so silently sometimes. And that kind of floors me still, because I think that's incredibly lucky. And I try to do that sometimes in my life, but I also think it's a really hard thing to see somebody who's clearly suffering and then offer to help.
Yeah. It feels scary, and it also sets you up for a spiral of all your own self-doubt of, like, well, what if I can't? What if I, you know, then you're in, like, what if I can't take this on? What if I'm not capable of helping? Mm-hmm. What, you know, all of that. Jamie, I have to say, like, I heard you say, you know, I'm done, whatever. I think you are one of the bravest people I know. And, like, one of the things that I think is so cool about you, a number of things, but your curiosity, I think that your career arc is incredible. I think you've become so accomplished in this, particularly the last decade. And I think you just keep pursuing things. Like, the episode of This American Life you referenced before, 10 Sessions, I think about it all the time. It's an extraordinary hour of radio. Everybody should listen to it. And in it, you spent 2 weeks in Seattle undergoing a therapy called cognitive processing therapy. It's also called CPT. It's supposed to help people overcome unhealed trauma in just 10 sessions, hence the name of the episode. How did it feel to do that? Because you recorded yourself doing this very intense therapy. I mean, I think it was such a service to people. Anyway, you talk. No.
Well, first you're going to make me cry, and that's very difficult to talk through. But thank you for saying all of that, because it means a lot to me.
Oh, you did make her cry.
You really did.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm terrible. I'm just very proud of you. Go
thanks.
Ahead.
Well, it's also because we've known each other for so long. From it's when true. We were babies.
When we were fucked up babies, yes.
And I feel the same way about you and your career and everything that you've done. But, you know, 10 sessions was something that I think... That was one of the rare moments where I actually did know it was going to be really, really hard, really intimate, and really scary, and possibly, I mean, I was afraid for sure before I went, and I didn't know what it was going to be like. I didn't know what it was going to be like to air all of it, but I worked with this producer, Susan Burton, and Ira Glass, and then everyone on This American Life. But initially, you know, talking with Susan just about the process of doing it and how we were going to do it, it was very much, I trusted her a lot, and I felt like we were going to figure out a way to do it, that, you know, we were going to explore this possible therapy and therapy in general in a way that isn't heard enough. I think people are still, I mean, I think when we talk about stigma, like there's still a huge cross-section of the population that thinks about therapy and is like, ah, that's not really for me. And then also it's not available. I mean, it's just too expensive. It's prohibitive and not covered by insurance a lot of the time. And so this idea that you could do something in 10 sessions and that it really could shift the way that you approach the world was kind of amazing to me. So I felt like it was amazing and scary. But I felt like I really, really trusted Dr. Kaysen, who is the doctor who was going to do it with me. And we had talked extensively beforehand about kind of process. You know, she consulted an ethical psychiatrist, I think. I can't remember exactly what her title was, but she consulted about what it would mean to kind of actively do journalism and therapy at the same time. And there was a lot of preparation that went into the 2 weeks that ended up unfolding. And I think that because I felt so secure in that, and part of that security was also if the 10 sessions were so scary and so intimate that I couldn't air them, then I wouldn't. Like, that was part of the conversation I had with Susan. And, you know, I never thought that that would be the case because I am a pretty open person, and I did feel like it was an important thing to try and figure out and do. And I wanted to do it, like, professionally. It was this new challenge of, like, how do you tell this story in this way? And it was really different for me. You know, so I think that was sort of how it felt okay to do.
Right.
And we should say that you were processing a young sexual assault, just because I think the context is, I didn't give context to it, but do you think it worked?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it changed my feelings about just how I deal with a lot of things and also what my expectations are for life and for what my life should feel like and look like, and, you know, how I want to be treated by people around me and how I want to treat people. It worked in the sense that I felt really changed by it, and in a really, really positive way. You know, I still cry ridiculously at things, as evidenced from previous moments. But the process of it, just, it's another tool, right? It's like what I was talking about earlier, where all the tools you can build to help in terms of moving forward and knowing that they're there, they're all helpful. When I think about things that get really complicated on my mind, I try and go back to kind of some of the worksheets. I try and like think about all the different narratives, like all the different possibilities. And a lot of my anxiety has really dissipated. Not all of it, because life is life. But, you know, I think that when Mental came out, it was really, really hard for me to accept when people said nice things about it, that people responded to it in certain ways, and to actually enjoy the process of releasing a book, because it's, I mean, writing a book and releasing a book is a trauma in itself, because it's so crazy. But then, you know, when it's awful. And when this book came out, I just have had a different experience. I really have felt like every time something positive is happening, I really can hear it and feel it. And I'm excited for the book and I'm proud of it. And I feel, and it's a different kind of book, so maybe that's part of it.
Right, you're not centered in it. Yeah. So it's not like, it's much harder when you're writing a memoir and you're like, oh, fuck.
You're like,
they
didn't like me. Like, why? Exactly. Why didn't they like me?
Or they did like me. Why?
Yeah.
You know, that's another one.
Like, what's wrong with them? Like, they're like, aren't reading closely enough.
Totally.
Yeah.
100%.
So, Jamie, I was just going to ask, because we should wrap up, how can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, email, you know, whatever. I'll respond to almost anything. So,
And it's under your name?
Jamie Rose Lowe is my Instagram, and jamieroselowe@gmail.com is my email. And Kick Like a Girl 1 is my Twitter, because I started tweeting when I was covering Women's World Cup for ESPN. And I was like, I hate Twitter, but I guess this will be my handle. And now I'm stuck with it forever, which is fine. And then Facebook is Jamie Lowe. And it's spelled like Jamie, J-A-I-M-E. Because I think my parents maybe thought I would be a Latino male when I was born.
Thank you so much for coming on. This has been really fantastic.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It's been really wonderful to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to Everything is Fine. We are your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like this show, as I say every week, please rate and review it on the platform where you're listening. If you don't, please don't say anything at all. You can find us on Patreon if you're looking for exclusive merch or exclusive episodes. We have a lot of fun stuff happening this month. It's patreon.com/everythingisfine. We're also on Instagram at EIF Podcast. We're on Facebook and Twitter. You can find Kim at her blog, girlsofacertainage.com. And if you want to email us, we love hearing feedback. It is everythingisfinethepodcast@gmail.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.